Take out your New Testament and turn to John chapter 3. We're studying the miracles of Jesus, and this is the second miracle. It's recorded by John. To some of the wives here, I enjoyed being with your husband yesterday. We had a good men's retreat, good food, good fellowship, a lot of laughter, a lot of inside jokes and smirks and all those things that happen with people who've known each other for a while. It was a good day, and I hope none of you grumbled about rain this morning. We need it, but sometimes we don't want it on Sunday morning when we're going out in it. But it's not much yet that I can see, but it is some, and maybe more is coming. That's a good thing. Want to read you a comment. It's from the book Lament for a Son, written by Nicholas Walterstorff. It's not my goal to bring back difficult memories, but it's designed to set the scene for what we're about to study from John 3, beginning at verse 43. One Sunday afternoon, a numbing telephone call brought news to a mountain climbing accident. And Westerhoff, in his book, reflects upon his painful feelings. Gone from the face of the earth, I wait for a group of students to cross the street, and suddenly I think, he's not there. I go to a ball game and find myself singling out the 25-year-olds. None of them is he. In all the crowds and streets and rooms and churches and schools and libraries and gatherings, a friend in our world, on all the mountains, I will not find him, only his absence. And in pulling together notes over several years on the book of John, my favorite of the Gospels, when I'm studying it, I guess the others are too, I ran across this that helps us to maybe understand what's going through the mind of this official's because of the circumstances he's dealing with. Westerhoff continues, "When we gather now, there's always someone missing. His absence as present as his presence. His silence as loud as our speech. Still five children, but one always gone. When we're all together, we're not all together. It's the nevertheless that is so painful. Never again to be with us, never to sit with us at table, never to travel with us, never to laugh with us, never to cry with us, never to embrace as we leave for school, never to see his brothers and sisters marry, and the rest of our lives we must live without him." When you hear that and study this parable, it gives you a deeper meaning that I think is useful. Putting yourself in someone's shoes, the Indians used to say, walk a mile in my moccasins. Walking a mile in someone else's shoes, you understand their emotions, their endeavors of effort, whatever it's around, you understand it. John 4, beginning at verse 43. After the 2 days, he left for Galilee. Now, Jesus himself had pointed out that a prophet has no honor in his own country. And when he arrived in Galilee, the Galileans welcomed him. They had seen all that he had done in Jerusalem at the Passover feast, for they also had been there. They had gone to Jerusalem to celebrate the Passover feast, to remember the Passover feast. Once more, he visited Cana in Galilee. And that's where we were last week in John 2, where he turned the water into wine. And there was a certain royal official whose son lay sick in Capernaum. And when this man heard that Jesus had arrived in Galilee from Judea, he went to him and begged him to come and heal his son, who was close to death. The obvious question we should ask, as we don't have to rush, again, let's understand perhaps what's taking place. What would you do on behalf of a loved one? What actions are you willing to go to? Maybe extreme. Not that this one is. What are you willing to do for your loved ones? Linda, I heard a word, I think. Yeah. Everything and anything. We can make a list, but it's all going to fit into the large category, anything and everything that we need to. We will do anything for those who are special to us, especially immediate family, but even beyond that to some extent. So here's a royal official. Some suggest that it's one of Herod's, works in Herod's court, I guess we would say. But he hears of Jesus, and this is early in the ministry, and he hears of Jesus, and he knows where he is, and he goes up to him, and he begins begging him to come and heal his son. And the assumption, and it's the correct one, I think, who, when he left, was close to death. So he makes the journey with the heavy need on his heart, and it's a serious circumstance. And Jesus says, unless you people see miraculous signs and wonders, you will never believe. Now, John uses here two of the three words we used to define a miracle last week, teros, semion, and he actually, when you look at this, the word miraculous signs in the New International Version is not teros. It's not semion, it's teros. So John used a different word, and the translators did not translate it probably the way they should have. And then, of course, wonders is the word dunamos that we saw last week. So teros and dunamos. Both of them speak more to the person, the power, the event itself. You will never believe. Why did he say that? Whose benefit was that for? Was it harsh? All the above. All the above. He's looking at it from a broad view, stepping back from the situation, and realizing that he did not perform miracles for any and every reason, for any and all causes, for any specific group. And what we're going to come to realize as we study these, most of them did not even require faith. It was performed so as to achieve what miracles were performed for, to authenticate the messenger or the message. They weren't ready for the message or the messenger. Thinking that give me a dunamos, give me a teros miracle that knocks my socks off. That's what the Pharisees asked for, and Matthew 13 describes that for us. 10, actually, I think Matthew 10. We don't want to do anything. It's going to be so amazing that we're forced to believe. And Jesus is essentially saying that here to that generation, but he's saying it in front of this father. And the royal official said, "Sir, come down before my child dies." What does he tell us with that simple statement? What's the greeting tell us? When you approach someone, sir, it's respect. It's perhaps acknowledging the age that they might have, the age difference between you and them. It also tells us when he makes the statement, with all due respect, you'll hear that in movies, sitcoms, you'll read it in books that you read. All due respect, I understand what you're saying. I respect who you are and I respect what you're saying, but I need to get to something else. Sir, come down before my child dies. He had one thing on his mind, and it was that one thing on his heart. His heart was revealing itself. No argument, only a respectful request. My son needs you. Jesus replied, "You may go, your son will live." What did we see last week with 120 to 150 gallons of water put in big containers turned into wine? Any special words? Did he touch the brim of the water on those large containers? Not at all. And it's different than what we sometimes suggest. It's certainly different from the miracle workers of our day that don't work miracles. It's a game. It's a show, somewhat psychological in its origin. No grabbing them and shaking them and saying magic words and all of that. Jesus thought, and water turned into the best of wines. Here he speaks about something at a distance, and that's why in the Gospel of John, in this period of consideration, we're seeing what people do after something has occurred, and it's asking us, what are you going to do based on what you've just seen and heard? The wine master of quality, the best. Here, Jesus is the master of space and time. He heals at a distance. He just says the word, if you will. He makes the decree so as to... I've wondered some... Well, you tell me, why did he say these things to his father? Here's the hint. Who was separated from a son who was close to death in his mind. Why did he say these things to the father, still separated from his sick son? Terry? To give him peace on the way back. I think exactly that. Jesus relates to this man. He is moved to this man's effort, to his request, and to the coming moments, minutes, hours that he will go through. Terry?
You know, we often say humanity is the same. It doesn't really change. Think of Naaman. He thought the prophet would come out and wave his hands and do big, and he just said, go dip in the water. And today people want big, fancy, showy.
Yeah, humanity's the same. Terry began and took us back to Naaman, needing to be healed of leprosy, expecting the prophet to take him to some magnanimous clean place or some actions, and he basically says, go dip in the Jordan, and the person who had come to him walks away. That's not much. It can't be anything successful, he must have thought. And his servant told him, if he had told you to do something different, big, fancy, would you have done it? Yeah. Do what he tells you. Essentially, he's told. Do what he tells you. Your son will live. I love 50B. And again, John shows us by his words things that are important for us. The man took Jesus at his word and departed. If he had done that after months, 2.5 years even, of miracles, I could understand it. I'm not sure I understand his response. He did not have a long list of proof as to Jesus' power to bring about such a healing. But if you're going to go to someone and ask their advice, ask for a healing in this case, doesn't it make sense you would do what they told you to do? In that way, it makes sense. But in so many ways, it really says something about this official for a Roman leader. It's really amazing. I'll do what you say. I believe what you're saying. And he turns and he leaves. And while he was on the way, his servants met him with the news that his boy was living. The Greek text would say still living. And when he inquired as to the time when his son got better, they said to him, "The fever left him yesterday at the seventh hour." And what did he do? He didn't have a Timex watch. They would still be ticking if he did. That's the Timex advertising slogan that's been out there for decades. A Timex goes on ticking. But in today's vernacular, he did this. When did you say he got better? And John tells us that the exact time at which Jesus had said to him, "Your son will live. That's when the father realized, that's when. And what we would surmise, if it was a fever supposed to lead to death, the fever either broke and he was no longer very lethargic, or he showed other signs, but whatever happened, whatever was shown, it tells us that he's going to be okay. He's going to be okay. The exact moment when Jesus said what he said, that's when his symptoms, his illness, the worst of the fever, whatever it would be, that's when he was better. Why is this miracle given to us? The next part of a verse tells us. What does it tell us? Because of the miracle, the healing of the son at a distance, showing a mastery over time and space, he and his household believed. He and his household believed. That's why we have the record of it, and that's why it was performed. And if you read the latter stages of John's gospel, he wrote these things, and there are others that he could have written about. Books would have contained all that he could have written about, but they were written that we might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. It's a book of belief. And when we make it a list of what you must do in order to be saved, we're not listening to John himself, who tells us the reason the book was written. And being saved begins with believing something. But that's not the end of the matter. It's only the beginning. And as I have said to people over the years, what does someone do when they believe who Jesus is, was, what he did, what he spoke? What do they do? Acts 2, verse 36, 7, 8. They were pricked in their heart. They repented. They asked, what must we do? Repent and be immersed in water in order to have sins forgiven. Now that's when you put the full picture of salvation alongside this belief idea. The whole gospel of John is so that people would believe in Jesus. And this is the second of John's miracles. And it's the second sign, there's the word semeion, that Jesus performed having come from Judea to Galilee. Your comments. We're not in a hurry. It's a fairly simple, and we've heard it before, miracle. Your comments or reflections. Tom? Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Tom mentioned that he did have belief and a faith in this unknown person. And yet what he knew about him told him that this is where I need to go. This is what I need to ask for. There certainly was faith on his part. But it's not revealed to us in most of the miracles that it was a faith that was specified, asked for, or asked for proof, if you will. And that's the miracles workers today, that if someone's not healed as they would supposed to heal them, it's where they didn't have faith. They didn't really believe that I could do it anyway. I, of course, don't believe in miracles today in that sense. Don't believe we need them. We don't have a new message. We don't need a new messenger. We have the revealed Word of God already. But obviously, it was needed at this time, for this period of time. Richard? Yeah, a powerful man. Tom alluded to the fact that he had to be kind of come from where he was to go to a relative unknown. Remember how John introduced the section? Jesus himself pointed out that a prophet has no honor in his own country. So he begins to show the honor that people from other places gave Jesus. And then wanted to take him back to Capernaum, which was one of his central locations for his 3 years of ministry. When you go into Matthew's accounts, 10, 11, 12, he's going to perform 8 of 9 miracles in the area of Capernaum, just because it's mentioned here. And he chastises them for their lack of belief, and he makes the astounding observation that if Sodom saw what you've seen, it would still be here today. You've had all this opportunity and it's done nothing for you as far as their belief and following him. A prophet is without honor in his own country, Christ said. And we actually looked at that when we first came, that first couple of weeks. Yeah, didn't need a lot of actions, a lot of words, a lot of performance, show, Terry used. He had a need. He went to the person who could reach, who can meet that need. Now, we're going to deal with that principle in our sermon this morning from John 14, 1. Any other observations? Tommy?
Just due to the fact that his job
No. Yeah. Yeah, he was working for someone who had no allegiance toward Jews or a Jewish leader, for that matter. Certainly one who was beginning a public ministry and already creating quite a stir. Luke is more chronological. John is more situational. But we're told it's the second miracle that Jesus performed. So we have some timing because of that. Darius? Yeah. When I was in Madeira, it's the first place we worked when we just came back from China. One of the elders was diagnosed with leukemia, and it was in the later stages. And he ended up going to Stanford on a numerous number of occasions to let them use experimental medicines with no guarantee. But it gave him quite a few months. A lot of it somewhat quality, but not necessarily all the time. And he was sitting right there one Sunday morning when we studied one of the miracles. It doesn't matter which one. And I said to them, the audience, with him hearing it, I wish I had or someone we know had the gift to heal spiritual leaders that churches don't need to live without. We don't need to lose them. They're too important to us. And several people were certainly in agreement. This elder was a tremendous example of how a Christian is faithful to the very end, to his family, to his church family, doing any and all things to the best of his ability to the very end. We would have suspicioned that. We would have expected that. But having it to look back on, maybe it's better that the circumstances moved forward exactly the way they moved forward. Maybe we didn't need a miracle worker at that time because we had a person who believed in the miracle worker. And that's what we see here. Not only did he believe, that's what we would expect, but his household heard the story, knew the facts, understood. He didn't even come here. What did he exactly say? What? That's all he said? And the end result, they believed. They believed. Well, let's look at the next miracle. It's in John 5. Yes? Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. 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 John gives us enough information, but he doesn't stop with just one thing. As we just heard, he wanted him to come with him, but he took him at his word. And then as he was on his way home, he was told that what you were told came true. And it brought forth belief. Taking him at his word mattered. He didn't stand there and keep asking. He didn't argue. He didn't say, wait a minute, I need something else. He came to the right person. He received what he needed, and he had the common sense to do what he was told. And that sometimes is difficult. Richard? Yeah.
Did he fully believe? So like the complete.
Yeah.
When you say you fully believe, but he had to have belief to believe. And if he didn't, then it'd be like the guy going over Niagara Falls on a tightrope, and he goes across and they all cheer, and he says, "Do you believe I can do it?" And they go, "Yeah." And he says, "Okay, who's going to go with me?"
There you go. Yeah, you're going to follow me in that belief. No question. A belief is not a certain circumstance that has an exact moment necessarily. It's fluid. He believed something about Jesus that led him to go there. He accepted him as his word that enabled him to turn around, not knowing the result. And the result, John tells us, brought he and others to believe in Jesus. Was there something lacking? Perhaps. The point is, it fits John's pattern of belief. This brought forth belief. No question. The next parable has all kinds of... Well, it takes good hermeneutics to study this parable. Let me just tell you ahead of time if you haven't studied it recently. Sometime later... So again, a timing element that John gives us. Jesus went to Jerusalem for a feast of the Jews. I've written between the lines, it's probably the feast of Pentecost. Now, there is in Jerusalem near the Sheep Gate, and that's a geographical location, Jerusalem with a city wall. A sheep gate was one of several openings in the wall, which in Aramaic is called Bethesda. If you look at the rendering, some manuscripts Bethsaitha, other manuscripts Bethsaida. So the exact word there has three possibilities. That's not germane to our discussion, but it is part of what's given to us. And that pool, surrounded by three covered colonnades. We would say, because it's not a word common to us, but it's three covered porches, three covered spaces around this pool near the sheep gate. And here a great number of people used to lie. So they would come to the pool, they had covered porches, and they would come to this pool. We haven't been told why yet, but great numbers of disabled people would come here. Then John tells us the blind, the lame, and the paralyzed. And then it happens. I don't know about you, but if you have a study Bible with notations at the end, we're told there's no verse 4 in the original text. It wasn't in the original text. New American, American Standard, and NIV and others, ESV I suppose too, go from verse 3 to verse 5, but we have an alternate rendering. We have verse 4 that's given to us as a study note to explain what we're about to be told. Let's let John tell us in his words, one who was there had been invalid for 38 years, one among the blind, the lame, or the paralyzed. And when Jesus saw him laying there and learned that he had been in this condition for a long time, 38 years, he asked him, "Do you want to get well?" Now this is asking for some response, some acknowledgement, if you will. "Sir," sign of respect, the invalid replied, "I have no one to help me into the pool when the water is stirred. While I'm trying to get in, someone else goes ahead of me." That's why we need verse 4. In the alternate text, what are you talking about? What are you talking about? Let John tell us. A lot of people, apparently the water in the pool was stirred somehow, I'll add that, and they thought it meant something. And they believe that while the water is stirring, if we get in, it's going to perform what we would need it to perform. If you're lame or blind or an invalid or paralyzed, rather, you want some healing, some relief. Here's the rendering that hopefully your study Bible has down at the bottom. I'm beginning at verse 3. Because it's part of what's given to us. The word paralyzed, verse 3 ends, "And they waited for the moving of the waters." From time to time, verse 4 is given in an alternate rendering, "From time to time, an angel of the Lord would come down and stir up the waters. The first one into the pool after such a disturbance would be cured of whatever disease he had." And that's the belief that they had. They believed that the stirring of the water had some magic attached to it, miraculous attached to it, better word, from an angel, a messenger of God, and I've got to get in there now. Do you want to be healed? I do. But I don't have the ability to get in the water when the water is stirred at just that moment, and there's a whole lot of people getting in ahead of me, is what John tells us. Jesus said to him, "Get up, pick up your mat, and walk." And at once the man was cured. He picked up his mat and walked. And then John tells us the day on which this took place was a Sabbath day. And so the Jews said to the man who had been healed, "It is the Sabbath. The law forbids you to carry your mat." He replied, "The man who made me well," John tells us he gives God the credit, not the stirring of a pool or anything else. "The man who made me well said to me, 'Pick up your mat and walk.'" They asked him, "Who is this fellow who told you to pick it up and walk?" The man who was healed had no idea who he was, for Jesus had slipped away in the crowd from where he was. Later, Jesus found him at the temple and said to him, "See that you are well again. Stop sinning so you're physically cured. Let's deal with the spiritual. Stop sinning, or something worse may happen to you." The man went away and told the Jews that it was Jesus who had made them well. Now, several things have just occurred. What happens when you haven't walked for 38 years? You're not going to walk. You're certainly not going to get up immediately and walk. And as we know from some here who are going through mobility issues from their lack of ability to be mobile for a period of time, if you don't use it, you lose it, the muscles tell us. You just have to be retrained, therapy, all the things that would be necessary. Did that happen here? He picked up his mat and walked. Of course, it wasn't heavy. That's not the point. The point is he did what he was told and there was a healing, but he didn't know who did it. And what did he go and do? John makes sure we know that. Where did he go? Went to the temple. What was he doing at the temple? I'm going to add something that's probably not correct, but in his heart and his mind, he was jumping for joy at the temple. He was joyfully worshiping and giving credit to God. He went to the temple to acknowledge the source. I would suggest jumping up and down, something he hadn't done for 38 years. An immediate, full healing that didn't need therapy and 8 months to get back to where you once were. Huh? He was invalid and he... You don't see the temple in verse 14? Found him at the temple? Yeah. Terry was back somewhere else. Looking at another point, he went to the temple and said to him, he found him worshiping. Tommy?
Do you get the impression that this was actually a stirring divine angel of people getting healed, or was it superstition?
I think there's probably, well, we only have a conjecture. Everything I've ever been taught or read tells me something happened to the water occasionally. If you've ever been around a swimming pool, sometimes a pump comes on to circulate the water, and it creates a movement of the water. And so we believe there was a movement of the water that they superstitiously would have thought, well, this is something from God. It's an angel stirring the water, the assumption is, with his finger or hand. And they were determined to get in. Now, what we're not told, because we know it didn't happen that way, did anyone all of these years who got in first, did they come out healed? That's the supposition that would be inferred if an angel did it and we need to get in order to be healed. The first one in would be healed. It was something, well... In my mind, it's when you're in deep physical need, you'll believe anything and do anything that people tell you to do. You'll take herbs, you'll take medicines, you'll not take herbs or medicines, you'll do a number of things because you're desperate. And over time, a stirring of the water, I haven't heard anyone suggest that that never happened. We're just told that what they thought was happening, and that's why in the translators or the scribes transferring this into English, it did not make sense, so they gave us the reason why they believed what they believed. I think there's 42 verses in the New Testament. I've lost the exact number. It's in the low 40s. That if you look at the study notes in the New International Version, there's verses left out. But there's an explanation for it. Usually it tells us it wasn't part of the Masoretic text, one of the earlier texts. So we're told why we need the explanation. Turn with me just for reference sake, and then the time is gone. Turn to the last verses of Mark 16, the two most reliable manuscripts do not have Mark 16:9-20. So there's 21 verses right there. But they're listed because we believe they really happened. they fit something that's real, but Mark did not put them in this place when he wrote his gospel. So there's a rendering to tell you why, explaining, and it's just being true to the text. The original manuscripts did not include verses 9 to 20. We give them to you because it's believed, the translators, it's believed this fits and it's true. But it wasn't part of Mark's original manuscripts. Apparently added in later manuscripts. Thank you. Let's go.